Good morning. And welcome back. Happy New Year to everybody. We'd like to welcome everyone to the study session of May City Council for Thursday, January 8th, 2009. We all excited? Yeah.
Okay.
Item number one on the agenda is remove the items. I like that. Review the items on the agenda for the January 12th council meeting. That's next Monday's council meeting. So, page two. Page three. By the way, I noticed we have a lot of liquor license applications. I heard on the radio today that Mesa doesn't allow liquor, and we're a dry city. I just wanted to make that comment because I.
That's why we're all yelling at work.
Okay. Page four. Yes, Councilmember Higgins.
5F.
5F. Yes.
5F. Fire hydrant question. Anybody? Anybody? Fire hydrants? I can wait. I can ask somebody else. I just wondered, are these replacement fire hydrants, or are these new fire hydrants for new developments that we're putting in? Oh, I'm sorry. Wait. Oh, yeah, and I had another question on that. Okay. It's early. Focusing. That's that, like, meter that goes on a fire hydrant when someone's building something, and they are using the fire hydrant water to spray down the dirt and that type of thing?
Yes, Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, these are movable water meters that are attached to the fire hydrants. They're the real long assemblies that you do see strapped onto a fire hydrant, and they are used for construction, watering down areas, et cetera, et cetera.
So,
and they are replacements.
Is there some type of cost in that to the user that actually helps pay off that cost of those water meters?
They have to pay a deposit on the meter plus the cost of the water that they're using it.
And not like a fee that, you know your meter's lasting 3 years and it gets used X amount of times, and in addition to a deposit?
I would have to go back and look. I can't remember off the top of my head.
But it's part of the cost of the whole utility. So
yes.
Overall, it gets rolled into the rate. So
yeah.
It does get paid for.
Yes, there is a cost recovery built into the system.
Anyway, okay, thank you.
Okay. Anything else on page four? Page five? Councilmember Fenter?
Thank you, Mayor. Had a couple questions on 5J. If someone could answer that about the bidding process, and this was rebid. My specific questions. It mentioned about they had to take it back and then rebid it to include some federal labor requirements, and then there was some cost savings. I was just curious how that all came about.
Good morning, Mayor, Councilmember Fenter. Yes, we did rebid this project. This is a CDBG or a federal grant project, primarily covered by the grant, and we have to include the federal paperwork. The paperwork we needed to include was the Davis-Bacon wage rates. The wage rates are all associated with all of the federal programs. So we found that, and we rejected the bids and went out with that in the bid package. At the time, we anticipated that it might increase the bid amount. Those late wage rates are a little bit higher. So we worked with Parks, and they found a different type of playground unit that Dana had on closeout special. So what we did was we bid the base bid, similar to what we bid 3 months ago, but with the Davis-Bacon wage rates. And then we bid an alternate for the other playground set, and we ended up about $64,000 cheaper than we did 3 months ago. Wow. On about a $250,000 contract.
Well, as a follow-up then, I noticed the original bidder was unable to meet that. Was it because of the federal requirements, or was it because of the restructuring?
No, he rebid it, but was not the low bidder on this time.
Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. Page six, Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, it's on 6C.
6C?
6C, okay. 6 Charlie. It's not really a question about the actual lease agreement or anything, but something that was brought up. in this item, in talking about water rights and selling water, I just happened to go to a lecture the other day from a professor from Michigan Tech, and he was actually talking about how people in investment are buying water rights now because water will be more expensive than oil in the future. And so I just wondered what, like, historical data are we using to base the fact that, oh, we don't need that water anymore?
Good morning.
I mean, not water, but, you know, like, no. You know what I'm saying.
Well, Catherine, why don't you come up?
Yeah, I'm going to defer to Catherine.
That's why it's not right.
Is the question related to the lands in Pinal County?
Yes.
Okay.
And it just, you know, came up in this slide.
Good morning, Mayor, Councilmember Higgins. We did. We continue to do studies on how much water we have in our portfolio, what water is certain, what water is less certain, how we can make sure that we have water for 100 years. And I'd be happy to bring those numbers to you again. But yeah, our numbers currently indicate that based on where we think our population will go and what we think the demand, what we think those people will consume in the future, that no, we don't really need to develop the Pinal County water farms as a water supply. We also believe that if our demand projections are wrong, which is obviously very possible, that there are other supplies that will be available to us that we could make use of at a much more economic rate.
Well, I guess I was looking at this more as an investment. I mean, we already mm-hmm. own it, and if it's one of those things where the price is expected to, you know, quadruple in the next 20 years, then maybe it's a good thing to have sitting in our portfolio.
I think the question, Catherine, correct me wrong,
yeah.
is while we own land with water rights in another county, the question is how we could ever transfer those rights to benefit Mesa in a different county in a different political subdivision.
Right.
What we've been able to do, though, is as we've looked at the possibility as we possibly sell property in Pinal County with those water rights, then we can use those proceeds then to secure possibly more water rights for Mesa in the long term.
Yeah, not really. The thing is, you have this asset, you know, you sure. don't want to sell low and buy high type thing. And if the trends in mm-hmm. research really say it is going to be an huge extravagant price tag, that maybe
sure.
it should just be
yeah.
held on to till the price.
I'll tell you, Councilmember Higgins, there's a couple of things that make development of it as a water supply very problematic for the city and possibly for other entities, and that potentially limits the value of those farms as a water resource. And in particular, it relates back to the Central Arizona Groundwater Replenishment District, which we call CAGRID. The way that the policies work today for CAGRID, whichever developers go in and lay claim to the groundwater supplies underneath their lands, they lock that groundwater up. And so future developers can't go in and try to claim the same groundwater supplies. And the way that mechanism works, more and more, the rights to more and more groundwater is being claimed by developers through the CAGRID process. As they do so, it puts some of our lands and our water rights at risk. The only way that Mesa could go in and actually protect that groundwater today would be to go in and actually invest in it fully as a resource and lay claims to it through a development plan that would be very costly for us to do. And, you know, our recommendation to date has not been to do that because we don't anticipate needing it as a supply. So in order to really secure it as a supply, we actually have to put the money into it, which makes it pretty problematic for us to keep as a water resource.
Not a simple issue.
No, I'm sorry, it's not.
No, right, thanks.
Okay.
Well, just to sum that up, I think that when these were purchased by the city, these lands, it was a different time and a different era. And at that time, it was foreseen that that would be a valuable resource, both real as far as, you know, wet water, the potential to possibly physically transfer that to Mesa, or to barter back and forth to trade.
Correct.
And that scenario existed at the time that those lands were purchased. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of things happen since that day, mm-hmm. and I think there's still the perception in the city and with many people that situation still exists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had people come up and tell me, don't you dare trade away our water future. The reality of the situation is that due to law changes, establishment of things such as CAGRID, which has changed the regulatory framework, and the realization from a political standpoint that physically transferring water from one distant county to another is, it's just non-existent, not going to happen. You're not going to realistically be able to physically transfer water from Pinal County up into Maricopa County and leave those as basically wastelands. It's not going to happen. Now, correct. That being said, those assets still carry a lot of value because there are water rights existing with those lands. And as real estate, those are mm-hmm. still very valuable over the long term. But from a water portfolio standpoint, the initial plan to utilize those to fill out, supplement our water supply, really we've taken a different route for a lot of reasons, both legal, political, mm-hmm. reasonable. We've been able to cover that potential deficit from other sources. Is that an accurate description?
And as a matter of fact, Mayor, I believe that when we initially purchased those properties, Craig can correct me if I'm wrong, I think the average price was about $2,500 an acre. I think our last sales, I mean, just to show you, I mean, the water obviously is very important, but we've now, the latest sales, I think we, on a per acre, we were closer to $50,000 an acre.
And one thing is that it's not that those water rights are not valuable, but they're embedded in the price per acre of the land because they go with the land.
Right.
They're not really usable for us as far as let's pump it there and ship it here.
Mayor, that's correct. And I think to Councilmember Higgins' question, it's also very problematic for another entity, say Tucson or Cagret or anyone else who might be interested in future water rights, to use those as a water resource themselves. Well,
and I guess what we're saying is that the idea that you can have a water farm, that anyone can have a water farm, in order to supplement their supplies or to physically ship, those days they used to exist, they don't exist now. And so the value of the water really goes with the land is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, Mayor, that's correct. I think that there's a much more limited role for water farms. Yeah. There's still a role, and there still will be a role, but I think it's far more
limited. You're leaving the door a little bit open as far as yes. Mesa's water.
As far as Mesa's concerned,
I think
that's
we need
correct.
To be crystal clear
yeah.
that as I understand it, that the potential of using the Pinal County water farms to fill out or round out our mm-hmm. water portfolio mm-hmm. is either very, very limited or non-existent. And they do
yes.
not factor into that, our long-term water
correct.
Plan.
They're not even calculated as part
They're
of our
They're not calculated as
that,
part of it.
Mayor, that is correct. And the door I left open was actually for the City of Phoenix and the State Land Department, which
well,
have
know,
water
we're
farms
talking
to
about
the
Mesa right now.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't want to leave this room right. with any misunderstanding that somehow we are yeah. holding on to this land because we need the water rights to somehow right. satisfy our water needs.
That is absolutely
and that,
correct.
As I understand it, that is not a fact right now.
Right.
And that our decisions on Pinal County are based more on real estate considerations, the fact that we own the land, and that they are a valuable asset to us, and at some point in time, somebody will develop that. We could, I don't really think that's in the cards because of the substantial investment that would be required, but at some point in time, somebody will want to develop that, and we will sell that land right. as a real estate transaction, not as a water transaction.
That's right. Mayor, that's correct. And in fact, when we recently reapplied for our 100-year assured water supply designation, we did not in any way, shape, or form include the Pinal County water farm lands.
Okay. Councilmember Richens.
If you want to be really clear, explain to everybody that you're not growing water on the water farm. It's groundwater pumping that's happening with that, correct?
Common misperception.
Now, how does this connect in with item 6I, the settlement of the...
Very good segue. And as a matter of fact...
I know that's on the next page.
Yeah, but let's go ahead. And Catherine,
wait a second. If it's on the next page, we have to wait till the next page. No, go ahead.
I'm always so excited.
And Catherine, when you talk about the settlement briefly, why don't you talk about the opportunity for us to secure up additional water rights
absolutely.
As part of that.
Okay. Let me just move over here, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Is that?
Oh, she wants to run the screen. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
She has a presentation.
Oh,
so you...
yeah.
While you're setting up, I want to just on 6A, just so everyone understands that. My understanding on that is that was an omission when we approved fees back in June.
It was for the other museums that they
yeah,
did.
All the other museums had in their rate schedule or their fee schedule the ability to change, and that was simply omitted. And we're
correct.
Just that's a technical correction.
Correct.
We're not trying to do anything that was done before. It was to bring that up to par with what we approved back in in June, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. I need to push F5, they tell me. Okay. Councilmember Richin, stop me if you have questions along the way, okay? All right. So in what we're dealing with generally is a general stream adjudication. That's what brings us all to the table. A general stream adjudication is just a way to decide who gets what water, and it's done through the courts. And end result is basically a court decree that says who gets what water and how you get to use it. Indian tribes, for the most part in Arizona, claim rights that are based on aboriginal occupancy and on the establishment of the reservation.
And that means they were there first.
Yeah.
They were there first, which is important in Western water law because Western water law is based on first in time, first in right. The Apaches themselves have never filed in the adjudication court. They have always disputed that it has any bearing on their sovereignty. But the United States has filed claims on their behalf in the general stream adjudication on the order of about 160,000 acre feet a year. I think that's roughly 20 to 25% of the annual flow of the Salt River.
Now, explain so everyone knows an acre foot is what?
It's the amount of water that would fill an acre 1 foot deep.
And one acre foot provides water for how many families?
Well, Mesa uses, to put it in context, the whole city of Mesa uses approximately 100,000 acre feet a year.
Okay, so this is a lot of water.
It's a lot of water.
Close out of this
city. It's a lot of water.
Okay.
It is, because the tribe has taken a very strong stance about its sovereignty, it is very important and very historic that we've even been able to come to the table. Meetings began back in 2006.
And once again, I hate to do it because I want to get down to the basics here because you deal with this every day. Their sovereignty, Indian nations, and a lot of people I don't think realize this, Indian nations are technically sovereign nations.
Correct.
And they operate under their own set of laws, and there's some overlap from federal, but literally they are nations within a nation, and specifically as it relates to things such as water rights.
Mm-hmm.
They view this as we don't have any jurisdiction over their water. They can use it as they want because they are a sovereign nation.
Absolutely correct.
And the law, in a lot of cases, backs them up on that.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So when they say they come into the table, they don't believe they have to come to the table.
Yes.
Because of their sovereign status.
Yes. And that's why it's been so important that we're where we are.
To water rights downstream.
Right. So the reasoning, as Vice Mayor said, the fact that they've come to the table is a big move on their part.
Huge.
It's a huge move. Okay. Yeah.
So the settlement process is a pretty straightforward one. A bunch of people sit around, including a lot of lawyers. We draft up a document. Necessary parties sign it. Settlement does require successful passage of federal legislation, and that again goes back to tribal sovereignty. The waivers of sovereign immunity that they have to enter into as part of the settlement require congressional approval. So do the waiver of their water rights. It all requires an act of Congress.
And Senator Kyle's been working diligently
as
the point person in Congress to bring this all the parties together and bring this together to
enact the
legislation at Congress.
Correct. And it's crucial that the entire Arizona delegation support the settlement.
Okay.
After passage of federal legislation, the state court, the general stream adjudication, reviews it and kind of gives it its stamp of approval. It's then binding. People can object. And if those objections prevail, we have a problem. But if not, then the settlement is actually binding on all parties.
What are the odds that someone might object?
Oh, 100%. But
okay. Well, then okay. You know,
but we work through it. So.
The fact of the matter is, all the big players, the Indian reservation, the Indian community, and SRP, the cities here in the valley, all the large players who would have a significant claim.
Absolutely.
Are all party to this agreement.
That's correct, Mayor. But you always have people throwing stones.
Yeah, I got you. There might be a rancher or somebody else who wants to come in as an individual and object.
Correct.
Okay.
So just real quickly, for those of you who might not know White Mountain Apache Tribe, where it's located, this map is obviously not to scale, but it is located in the eastern part of Arizona, close to Sholo. There's around 12,000 tribal members. Their reservation encompasses much of the Salt River watershed. They have an existing water use of around 12,000 acre feet a year. Real quickly, I'm going to go through some of the settlement terms. after the settlement is said and done, the tribe will have rights to about 52,000 acre-feet per year in comparison to the 160,000 acre-feet that the U.S. government claimed on their behalf. A little bit less than half of it will come out of the Salt River Basin. A small portion will come out of the Little Colorado River Basin. And about 25,000 of it will be CEP water that has a non-Indian agricultural priority, which is the second best priority in the CEP system. The tribe will receive federal money for various projects. Most important to them is a dam on the White River, which will help regulate flows for a surface water treatment plant for their capital at White River. One important settlement term that I need to point out is that that was different from the settlement we had with the Gila community is that we are, through the settlement, agreeing to support their appropriation requests with the federal government, because they will have to rely on annual appropriations from the federal government to get money for these various projects.
Should note, we've already verbally begun to support that and let them know. So we feel it's in their best to support them and their projects that they have that are important to them is a good faith effort to show we're trying to work with them to help them with their particular needs, which right. gives goodwill as far as trying to resolve the issues under this negotiation.
Correct. The tribe. Oh.
And Catherine, it's important to note, too, this is the second agreement with an Indian tribe in the state of Arizona Mesa's been involved in, which is extremely significant. Just in the last 5 years.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, thank you, Vice Mayor. And this one has gone through surprisingly quickly. As you recall, the settlement with the Gilas took, I don't know, 8-10 years. This one, we're only going on our third year. So it's been surprising. It's great. The tribe is agreeing to lease all 25,000 acre-feet of the CEP water that it will receive through the settlement will be leased back to various local cities, including Mesa.
And explain why it's a lease instead of a grant.
Well, technically, the CEP water will become an asset of the tribe, and the tribe cannot permanently alienate any of its resources.
Okay, now in English.
Okay, sorry.
They can't sell it.
Federal laws prevent them.
They can't
them
give
from
it away
selling.
Or sell it. They
Correct.
Can only lease it.
Correct.
It's a legalese that we're going through. That's why we say they lease their water rights.
Yes. Thank okay. you, Mayor. That was much better English.
No, it was just a better explanation. You used much better English, but mine okay. was. Mine was. We could at least understand mine.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha. Thank you. So again, they're agreeing to lease the water back to the cities, including Mesa, and they are agreeing to waive, and this is the important part, they're agreeing to waive their water rights, and that's really why we enter into these settlements, is so that we can stop suing each other, essentially. Some of the provisions of the lease, it is for 100 years, as the mayor mentioned, and we'll lease around close to 900 acre-feet of what I will call higher priority CEP water, and about 2,700 acre-feet of slightly less high priority, wait, that didn't make sense, slightly lower priority CEP water from them. Both kinds of water will be used as part of our 100-year assured water supply designation. And this goes to Councilmember Richens, your question about replacement supplies. Councilmember Higgins. So these supplies will be part of our future portfolio.
Quantity of water than anything we could ever imagine coming out of Pinal County for the city.
Absolutely.
Because it comes right to us.
And once again, yeah, this water actually flows our way. And the actual, doing your math, if we're using about 100,000 acre-feet a year, this is about 3.5% of our current water portfolio. Mm-hmm. So even though the numbers don't seem large, it's a significant amount.
It's a significant amount, and it's an important amount, okay. Yes. So just in summary, again, settlements, the reason we enter into them for the most part is they provide certainty. Everybody knows what they've got, and we don't have to continue litigation over who gets what water. It also, and this is one of the benefits we really saw in the Gila settlement, is it really brings communities together to defend common interests. And you know, I'm really happy to say that our relationship with the Gila community is very strong, and I think as a direct result of the settlement that we entered into with them, I think, Mayor, you would agree, we've already seen that with the Apaches as well.
Yeah, and just so you know, we went up, Catherine and Chris and I went up and met with the Chairman Lupe and others and had a very good It was a really good meeting.
Yeah.
And established a good relationship. And I think it went a long way toward getting this settled. And also met with Senator Kyle back in Washington. So a lot of people worked hard on this. So thank you so very much. I think Councilmember Richens has another question.
If you were to compare the amount of acre feet that you would get from, a Pinal County water rights and this settlement, what are the numbers? Do you know?
How much water we could potentially get out of Pinal County versus what this is? Oh, well, potentially we could get as much as 25,000 acre feet a year out of Pinal County. That's probably high, and that's a very uncertain number, again, because we have some difficulties actually protecting the resource in Pinal County unless we go in and spend the money to develop it. But the original plan when we purchased the farms was for 25,000 acre feet a year. This is, 3,500, a little more than that, acre feet per year. So the quantities are not similar, but again, we don't anticipate that we need the 25,000 acre feet from Pinal County. So,
again, it's hard to even answer the question, right? Because the reality is that water will, by really, as the mayor was saying, changes in state law and really the political consideration, that water will stay in Pinal County. It is not going to be transferred. And in that case, I think that would be considered as, we would have to, it'd be well water. That water is produced through wells, correct?
It is.
Whereas the water we're being delivered by through the Apaches is coming through surface water, is that
absolutely
correct? So again, the deliverables are much different too, and the certainty and surety of surface water is a much higher level of certainty than having to go through the groundwater, the wells.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, that 25,000 acre feet is really zero for us.
Right. Yes.
I mean, I think we have to, I don't want to be Devin and Blunt, but we can't leave the door open, because I still get a lot of comments and a lot of things from people who believe that that water is there for the taking.
Correct.
And I think we need to dispel that notion right now that somehow we have this vast reservoir of water sitting down in Pinal County that we can tap into at any time, because I don't believe that is either a practical, a physical, or a political reality that we will ever be able to tap into that water. I mean, even if we bartered it, once again, it's going to stay in Pinal County. And we're not going to be able to trade some upstream water for downstream water.
Mayor, I agree.
It's
absolutely.
It's not going to happen.
I agree. Yeah.
But I don't want to be blunt about it.
Okay.
It's not going to happen, though. Okay. Councilmember Richens.
One of the things I've come to realize recently is that there's a big difference between how the law treats surface water and how the law treats groundwater. And they're really treated separately, even though they're interconnected systems. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct, Councilmember Richens.
Thank you, Catherine. Any other questions? Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Appreciate all the hard work.
Sure.
Okay, anything else on page 7? Councilmember Higgins?
Item 6D, changing the construction completion. Oh, there's on McClellan Road. I have a couple questions as to, like, timing. Is there a fire concern with the delay of this? And has there been, like, neighborhood input about the concern of the delay of the road?
Yeah, this really has to do with traffic on McClellan. When we first negotiated the development agreement with Pinnacle Holdings, or Mountain Bridge Agreement, we required improvement of McClellan based on the number of permits issued for housing units north of it. But the developer came back, and those houses don't have any access onto McClellan. We talked to transportation and engineering about it. So really, McClellan is going to be improved when it's necessary to do that, when there's a secondary access road down to McClellan. So we really agreed with the developer that there was no need to develop it, because those houses couldn't actually, there wouldn't be any traffic on it.
So is the only road out onto McClellan the one that's just west of Ellsworth?
Correct. There's just that one secondary road that comes down from the one development in Mountain Bridge onto McClellan.
And they're building the houses way off to the, not way off, but to the west side.
They're
where
farther
they don't
west
have access
now. Correct. But even when they start developing to the north there, McClellan will be required to be improved once they develop that secondary access road.
Okay. And then there were some pictures that were included in the packet that I didn't get at all. And something called an emergency crash gate. Do you know what that picture is? It was included in the packet, because we had a lot of
maps. Isn't that typically a gate that's closed but only access for the fire department to come through?
Right.
Right.
But there's not a road. It would be going through landscaping and shrubbery,
Councilmember Higgins, usually those situations where we've planned those, even though it looks like just your typical landscape area, but it's been done in a way so the fire apparatus can drive across it in the event of an emergency.
Now, like what type of emergency that you wouldn't, I mean, you don't want to typically take a fire truck through a shrubbery.
Isn't that the one up north going up into the Madrid
development? Well, I had a hard time finding that on the whole.
Yeah, that was actually negotiated because we needed a secondary emergency access up into the Madrid subdivision, which is north of Mountain Bridge. There was a significant amount of public discussion as to connectiveness between Mountain Bridge and Madrid, and the final arrangement was there would be that emergency crash gate so public safety could get in an emergency situation. It's basically set up that they can just drive over what looks to be landscaping but is essentially just DG with some really small shrubs.
This would be a huge public emergency. This isn't a typical fire. This is like disaster.
If the main access into Madrid was blocked, that they'd have this as a secondary
Access. And that's big. That's right. Not your day-to-day. Emergency.
Public safety feels more comfortable. They don't ever want to get in a situation where there's only one way to get into that property. So in the case of it being blocked, they need to have secondary access. So that's
right.
So you're right. It would have to be a major issue.
And I think the issue was I didn't see Madrid isn't on the other map. So unless
it's
you know
just,
that
it's up north there, it's not shown as part of the Mountain Bridge development.
Okay, great. Thank
okay.
you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Anything else on page 7? Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, it was number 6F. We own the little property just south. Oh, there's our property, guys, south of the freeway. When it's actually, it's more of a city standards thing. Back to Christine. It's not. But in the little description, it says that because there's not water or sewage available, they would be installing a septic system. I didn't think we allowed septic systems to be installed in the city of Mesa.
I'm not sure on that. It's part of their feasibility period for the first 6 months to determine if they can do that or not, but I'm going to defer to somebody else that can answer that. I'm not sure.
If I can, Councilman Higgins, I think we do, based on county requirements, if the sewer line is too far away from the site, I forgot it was 300 plus feet, and the cost was more than $10,000, I think, something like that. So there is a provision that allows for that
really?
If conditions exist. Yes.
And this is somewhat of this is a remnant piece, correct?
That's correct.
Of the
of the Red Mountain Freeway.
Of the Red Mountain Freeway. So there really wasn't, it wasn't planned at it really initially at any time to deliver those types of
right.
utilities. So, but it is a remnant. We have a buyer who's interested, correct. Who can use it. So that's where we've been able to come with this.
And was this ever like offered to the Sunshine Acres for extension of their property since it borders them?
They were aware of it at one time.
Yeah.
I don't know. We actually
had talks with them. They were aware of it.
I've had those conversations with them, but I don't. It's such an odd piece. I don't know that it really served their purposes.
Yeah, as I recall, there were discussions, and of course the use of a septic tank here would be for a minimal office, I would imagine.
Yeah, we're really not.
So we would sell this. They'd have to come in for rezoning, site plan, the whole big thing, and I just had that question up front. Thank you. I'm sorry, Mayor. And then 6G, just only because this packet came late and I didn't have enough time to call everybody normally. So I guess it's more to Mr. Brady. 6G, talking about going into negotiation for more parking at the Sycamore Station. Are we already maxed out on the Sycamore Station parking? Or do we really need to spend money now? Or is this just,
Mayor, Councilman Higgins, a couple clarifications. This agreement really allows us, if we need to, go in and establish a lease. Now, the funding for this would be coming from the Metro Operations funding, so it's not a direct cost. At least for this fiscal year, they just took money out of their operating budget. In the future, we are basically about 5% of operating costs, so the cost to us would be 5% of whatever that lease was going to be. We're really not going to know if we need that until at least ASU gets going. They start January 20th. We're watching the park and ride closely. Like right now, you know, it's not totally completely full, but that is convenient parking. The property owner is interested in leasing that if we need it. So we just want to be in place with this agreement. So if we need to pull the trigger, we can and get those additional spaces.
Quickly.
Yes.
That's the point. Be able to respond as we see things happen quickly.
So do you see that the parking, it's going to, you think it will go way up when ASU goes back into session? I read something about no surface parking at ASU. Hot. Surface. Yeah. No that.
I do believe that we're going to see an increase when school opens, just like we see on the freeways and our surface roads.
And I think over time you're going to see fewer spots available at ASU.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah, the ASU.
I think they've been reducing some of that for other developments and things like
that. Yeah, part of their plan is to reduce and push their students to light rail.
Right.
And I know that, you know, for example, the old Lot 59, which is out along Rio Salado or whatever that's called now, and the Salt River used to be free. Started out as free, and now my understanding is it's literally several hundred dollars a year if you want to get any kind of parking on ASU. So they're actively pushing their students to not bring a car to campus. Right. That's part of their designated plan.
And they're also picking up students from that terminus to go take out to ASU Poly. So it's going both directions for ASU. So it could. We just want to be in a position that if we need to, we can.
Which
respond.
Raises all sorts of questions about ASU's participation in this, but we'll leave those for a different day because it sounds to me like they're doing a real nice job of piggybacking on this. But yeah, we'll bring that up with Dr.
Thank
Crow
you.
Sometimes. Okay, thank you. Anything else? Okay. Page 8. Page 9, Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, I have. I'm trying to read my notes from the other day. I'm sorry. 7F is a rezone at like Wrecker and McKellips. Okay, talk to you about this. This site is already. I mean, it's not a corner site. It's going up the street a little bit, and there's already a vacant property that used to be a service station that's kind of been in rehab but has been sitting vacant for years. On the other two corners of this intersection, there are already auto service facilities with multiple bays, and I just don't see this as another, you want to, you know, have one intersection of nothing but cars parked everywhere with auto bays. And my other issue with this is, as you get away from the corner and start moving down a street, you change the character of the neighborhood. It's no longer, you know, community commercial on the corner and neighborhoods. It's now we're just pushing that commercial into the neighborhood as we move up the street. So, and I know it's not the whole property, but when I have this huge vacant corner that's been there forever, I know this has been vacant forever too, but it's zone residential. I just don't like to see us keep moving instead of using property that's a possibility for this exact purpose. So I don't know if that was really a question.
Are you pulling it?
Am I what?
Are you pulling it, or do you just want to make?
Well, it's just an introduction at this point, so we still have time for discussion.
Okay, thank you. Anything else on page 10? Page 11.
Excuse me.
Did I skip something?
Yeah, you skipped page 10. Didn't you skip page 10?
I said page 10.
Oh,
well, is there anything on page 10?
I do. Just okay. Really, I just want to make a comment on 8B, the Banner Baywood extension. I just wanted to say that we are in ongoing discussions with the neighbors on some issues that have been going on for years, but none of which are going to hold up the approval of 8B at this time. So that was it. Thank you.
Okay. Page 11. Item 11 on page 11, if we could. This relates to the adjustments to salary, the 2% adjustment that are part of the financial plan that we've been discussing. And the reason why these items are on here, and for those following that don't have an agenda, 11A relates to the council members' salaries, 11B to the judges in our municipal court system and magistrate salaries, and 11C to the what Mr. Brady referred to as charter positions at one time. Just an explanation. By law, neither council members, elected officials, nor judges' salaries can be adjusted during their term of service. They can only be adjusted to apply to something. So we legally cannot go in and demand or adjust salaries. Now, that being said, just so there's no misconception, the judges have voluntarily offered to donate 2% of their salary back to the city. So thank you so very much for them. They are more than willing to participate with all other city employees in our program, and the judges will be going through a 2% salary reduction, but that is voluntary on their basis. We cannot do that. The same thing with the mayor and city council compensation. These items don't need to be voted upon, and we can actually pull them, but I want to have that discussion that any reduction from the council would be voluntary. And I'm assuming from discussion that is something we have bought into. If you are not willing to do that, you can either talk about it now or talk about it later, but we will also participate in the 2% reduction. Now, as it relates to the other charter officials, and these charter officials would be the city manager, city attorney, city clerk, and city auditor. Those positions are under separate contracts, which have a defined amount that are approved by the council. 11C is an item that we have presented so that we can adjust those contracts. So that's a little bit different issue because those can be adjusted. We have discussed this, the council has discussed it with each of those officers, and they have been willing to also participate. So this is really sort of a technical administrative way of taking care of applying the 2% to those, the 2% reduction to those positions that we cannot just say it's a 2% reduction. So
but it brings everybody in line.
It brings everyone in line. Everybody into this program, everybody in the city online, and everyone will be participating in the 2% reduction.
Correct. Are we going to spend more than the 2% on the council salaries to make the adjustment? Would it be cheaper just to...
You know, I think I just did.
Yeah.
I think I just... Our combined 2% reduction, I think I just used up more than that in staff time in doing that. So I don't know that we need to leave 11A and 11B on there. We can probably just remove those now that we've had the discussion, unless someone else wants to have that, because, okay? Well, let's remove 11A and 11B and just leave 11C and as that as an item, as item 11. Okay, anything else? Was that an accurate description, Ms. Spinner?
Yes, Mayor.
Okay.
Simple, clear English.
Simple, clear. I could have said...
No.
I'm not going to do that. I could have said that we couldn't alienate somebody of their salary. Where's Catherine? I'm sorry. That was too easy. Next item on the agenda, hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed pawn shop regulations. Denny, are you in charge here?
Nominally.
Okay. Well, then go right ahead.
Well, first of all, I think upon the PowerPoint, it shows that there's proposed annexation policy modifications, and I thankfully can say I know nothing about this. I can make it up as I go, but it probably wouldn't work. Pardon me? Hello? We've all been through this, I think, before, so we provided you with a new copy of the PowerPoint. There are really no substantive changes to anything that is in that, other than, I believe, on page 6 of the PowerPoint, you'll see we included some figures regarding the impact of secondhand stores. And let me kind of clarify that. I know it's in the council report, but just so everyone's clear, those are pure approximations based upon the November 2008 transaction records that we had. And they are purely approximations. Obviously, they are subject to change depending upon the extent to which, if we in fact decide to regulate secondhand stores, what we're actually going to regulate. So it could push it up, it could push it down. But at this point, that is a scientific wild guess about what I left that last part out. Yes.
A scientific wild guess?
Yeah. This is a family show.
Okay.
So it is actually subject, obviously, to change. So I guess where we are here is the direction of the council from the last time. You wanted us to include secondhand stores. We have done that. We can show you what we think the potential impact is. And I guess from this point, all we really need to do is get some direction from the council on which of the three proposed alternatives you would ask us to move forward with. They're listed at the end of the council report.
Just very quickly, Mike, and I think one of the things we asked for was to get a little bit more clarification as to what the issues were with the secondhand. As I understand it, the secondhand stores, items like Goodwill, Deseret Industries, those kind of things. You have both. Now, what kind of reported transaction do you have at those? Because my understanding is multi-year secondhand stores. Is there a difference between? Let me back up.
Only
is there a difference? Is there a difference between secondhand stores where I would guess at a Goodwill or a Deseret Industries or something like that, all of the items would be donated in? Are there items that are donated that need to be reported, or does this just relate to items that are sold to a secondhand store for which compensation is received?
As far as the difference between them, I'd have to let Mr. Schaefer answer that from the city attorney's office. Because I think our definition, as we looked at it here, is secondhand stores are for-profit organizations,
okay,
rather than nonprofits.
So it would only be for those like secondhand clothing and electronics and other ones where people come in and sell items to the store and then they're resold.
Right. I think that 501c3 corporations and things
would not,
of that nature would not be involved.
Would not
in this.
Be involved. Okay.
That certainly would be our recommendation.
Right.
Okay. Well, I just want to make sure that that's what we're talking about.
Right. In fact, Mayor, Council Members, as I think was expressed at an earlier presentation, this is one section of Title V, Chapter 7 that's being modified right now. The police department wanted to move forward with the pawn ticket transaction fee. There are other changes proposed to Title V, Chapter 7. And I believe one of those, one of the drafts to change the entire code that will be coming to council later on will clarify the 501c3 issue, or I should say 501c issue.
Okay. Now, when we talk about secondhand, are there differentiations between the items in a secondhand, or like if someone comes in and sells a pair of Levi's, would that also have to be ticketed and then reported?
Well, we've not defined that yet, Mayor. I think what we're looking at is, at least in our discussions, is something like the city of Phoenix is using. To come up with some dollar values and then perhaps identifiability of some of the items. Because quite frankly, I'm trying to remember the name of the jeans store, a Buffalo Exchange. If a kid comes in and turns in three pairs of used Levi's, and sells them, I'm not sure how you're going to record that. It's going to be very difficult. And if we're really looking at the idea here that this is about being able to track items to protect people from having an outlet for stolen property and to protect the vendors themselves, that seems somewhat counterintuitive. So we're going to have to define that. At this point, what's being reported by the secondhand stores, perhaps that's illustrative, is obviously handguns and weapons of all types, because a number of the stores that are currently reporting are in fact firearms dealers, and they are by federal statute required to report. We're also getting reports, obviously, on jewelry. Under state law, anything that is considered a precious item, wherever it is sold, with the exception of between jewelers that are exchanging materials, has to be reported. And the remainder of it appears to be largely things like game systems and small electronics that companies are voluntarily reporting to us. And I think that's probably a pretty good idea of what we would be looking at in terms of reportable items. That may expand slightly, it may contract, depending on how we define it. But that seems to be fairly consistent in looking at other cities in the state that are considering or have secondhand store ordinances now.
In fact, Mayor, Council, what the Assistant Chief and I have discussed is, and for purposes of clarification, the numbers that are presented on secondhand stores are an estimate of what's currently reported under the existing definition of secondhand goods. So in the city of Mesa, things like clothing aren't required to be reported. Some stores may voluntarily be reporting them, but what the Assistant Chief is talking about right now is what is being reported under the current code. Should the definition expand or contract with Council's approval, the revenue could increase or decrease, and also the number of transactions would corollarily increase or decrease.
Right, so right now we have a voluntary situation. Well, some of it's voluntary, some of it's required already by either federal or state law, and what we're being asked to do is to define that list, define what it applies to and to whom it applies, and then impose a fee.
Right, if we choose to go with alternative two, which would be both pawn and secondhand stores, we clearly have to make those definitions at some point so that the vendors themselves clearly know what it is they're going to be responsible for.
Okay, Councilmember Higgins?
If we went with alternative two at this time, is there a system in place to start work, or would you just, that would give you direction that you're going to start putting the policy together? And you not have to come back and talk about it again. Ever.
It is my sincere hope, Councilmember Higgins, that we never have to come back and talk about this again, but I'm also a pragmatist and realize that's highly unlikely.
But let's clarify for the council. We would, if we get authorization before it, I do believe we have the items on the agenda, correct? I can't remember. 7H. And we would move forward with that ordinance for Monday. Then what we will do is work through the implementation plan. You know, part of this, remember, is acquiring electronic system. I'm not trying to be careful what we call it so we don't exclude anyone. But we will look through a process so we can be doing this electronically. Now, we may be collecting the fee ahead of the time so we can collect some of the funds in order to have the funds available to enter into and purchasing of the software or the licenses or whatever we need to do. So that's where we need to begin. There will be, it sounds like what I hear from Jack, some continuing refinement of this section of the code that we may be bringing forward. But as it relates to the item of pawn shops and imposing the fee, we'll work quickly to work with the industry and begin to work with them on tracking and beginning to impose this fee for those transactions.
Right.
Go ahead.
So how, and since it's in the on the agenda 7H,
we would like to get direction. I think that's really what we need today, because we've kind of allowed ourselves the flexibility, depending on the direction here during the study session, of whether to either only go with the pawn shops or whether to include secondhand.
Or to do none of the above, potentially.
That's always another option. Thank you.
I think this is a great first step. I mean, we talked about pawn shop fees before, and then the including of the secondhand dealers, since, you know, start that big, huge ball rolling to get them all involved to help protect our community. I think that's a good, great thing. Thanks.
Councilmember Fenter?
A question for Detective Milburn. In your history, you've been here a long time. You have a good reputation with the pawn shops and other organizations. Do we have a problem at the secondhand stores with stolen merchandise in Mesa?
We do at times seize property from the secondhand stores, but the numbers between the two entities are vastly different, so to compare the two is not easy to do. But we do have times where we seize stuff from secondhand stores.
Would you say occasionally? Okay, thanks.
We're aware of.
Councilmember Summers?
On the other hand, even if we don't see the numbers in the secondhand stores as often as we do the pawn shops, we start throwing the net harder and harder into the pawn shop. They're going to figure out where else to go if they haven't already switched to eBay, but there's nothing we can do about that. So if we are going to proceed with this, I would prefer to see that net thrown a little bit wider and move for option two otherwise.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to say I concur with Councilmember Summers' comments.
on alternative number two.
You two? I think the consensus is to move ahead with alternative two. I'd be anxious to see how we really define those secondhand. That's my primary concern is that it's,
sure.
I think from a conceptual standpoint, we agreed that if we have the same type of transaction going on and the same propensity, big word.
What does that mean?
The chance for...
opportunity.
Opportunity, thank you. For some kind of misdeed or foul play to go on that we should cover that. But I'm a little bit leery that we still haven't quite yet tied that down as to how that would apply because, I want to make sure that we come up with some sort of thing that separates the three pairs of jeans at the Buffalo Exchange from those items that are really causing us potential problem.
And that's our concern as well, Mayor. I mean, to take and basically apply all the same requirements to the secondhand stores that would be we apply to pawn shops, we just might as well make them all pawn shops, and that's clearly not what their business is. The way they transact business, the way they do business is dramatically
I think
different.
What we're talking about here is we're looking at a type of transaction.
Right.
We're not looking at a type of business.
There you go.
We're really looking at the items involved in the transaction.
And therefore, if we're really going to regulate this for the purpose of stopping criminal activity, then we should go after the transactions wherever they occur. And it just so happens that they occur, for the most part, at pawn shops and to a lesser extent at secondhand stores. And I hope we keep that in mind that the types of transactions we want to stop. Let's go after those wherever they occur and wherever it's feasible to regulate that. Is that sound okay?
And we'll make that emphasis as we look at the code.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Good.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mayor, before Rich leaves, I want to at least recognize Rich will be retiring at the end of this month. Is that correct?
Correct.
And for his work, he's been relentlessly pursuing this item. I think it will be quite satisfying for him to be able to leave the city knowing that this has been put in place, and we appreciate his effort, especially on this topic and bringing it forward and really trying to provide clarification of what we're trying to do here and his work that he's provided for how many years with the city?
It'll be 28 tomorrow.
Okay. So thank you very much.
And in fact,
it does feel like it.
It's been going on the whole time. So,
Rich, thank you and congratulations and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Motion to block retire.
Next item, hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on proposed annexation policy modifications. Ms. Zelenka.
Good morning. My name is Christine Zelenka. I'm the Development and Sustainability Department Director, and I have with me today Angelica Guevara, who is one of our senior planners, and Angelica has taken over responsibility for managing the annexation process. We've got a quick presentation today to just ask for some direction on a policy change regarding the annexation process. We were here a while back, and we just want some, we have a slightly different modification that we're going to propose today. If we get that direction, then we'll come back probably on the 26th with the specific code changes that are required. So, Angelica, if you'd like to go ahead, if that's possible.
Mayor and council members, thank you. Like Christine said, we were here on October 30th to provide an update on the annexation policy and also talk about some of the related issues that we found in the last year and a half with processing annexations under the current policy. At that meeting, or some of the issues that we found had to do with public safety services and solid waste services. So at that meeting, council discussed the options and asked staff to come back with three options, which is why we're here today. Option one, which was it's the current process under which we're processing applications, basically indicates that we continue processing annexations applications by requiring annexation in order for property owners to receive utility services. As part of that requirement, property owners are required to make any improvements that are necessary to the property and also make payment of the annexation equity fee. Staff is recommending modifications to this option, and which is with some of those changes are going to be seen with options two and three. Option two was really the option that we presented at the last meeting that we were here, And it was the previous staff proposal, and that proposal encouraged annexation and allowed, or the proposal was to allow staff to enter into a utility service agreement with property owners to allow utility connections for properties when it was not in the city's best interest to annex. And it wouldn't have been in the city's best interest whenever we had issues with public safety or solid waste services. We felt that that option allowed us to streamline the process and to reduce some of the appeals that would be heard by the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and by council. But under that option, it would have allowed some parcels to receive utilities without having to annex. And staff was supportive of this option. So now we have option three, which is our current proposal, where it does encourage, does not require annexation in order to receive utilities when properties are located outside of our current city limits. So this utility services would be provided without consideration of annexation. And just to point out, under all three options, property owners are required to make all improvements on property or pay the associated fees, whether it's the annexation equity fee or the utility service fee. And like I said, staff is supportive of this option. And all annexation applications do include a fiscal analysis that are specific to that site. So under option one, there was no change. And under options two and three, the only impact to the city that we saw was unrealized state shared revenues.
Let me ask you something. The utilities we're talking about would just be sewer and water, correct?
Okay.
No other city services are involved under this proposal if someone does not annex into the city.
That's correct. Okay. If we only sell utilities, water and wastewater, public services are not provided. Public safety services,
water,
I'm sorry.
Water and wastewater.
Yeah, water and sewer is
are the only ones.
That's the, what, yes. When we call, talk about purchasing utilities.
Correct.
It's that's water
the only thing
sewer.
We're talking about.
Yes.
All right. Just want to be clear on that.
Yeah.
Correct.
And so, Mayor and Council, I think. Well, go ahead. Alex, you have the last slide. Did you want to finish?
It just has to do with implementation.
Where,
depending on the direction that we get, staff would come back, like Christine said, on the 26th of January with the ordinance changes,
right.
And we would reevaluate all 65 applications that we have currently in at various stages of the annexation process.
Right. Thank you. So, Mayor and Council, what really now the focus of the recommended proposal is that because we recognize there continues to grow concern about this idea of requiring annexation as part of utility services. And even then, once we do that with annexation, there obviously a continuing discussion and dialogue about can the city effectively be able to provide services to these developments that are coming into the city. What this proposal does is almost less of an emphasis, much more of a less of an emphasis on annexation, but continue to focus on as development continues to come to the city, and they do. Well, we still receive applications on a very regular basis from developments that are in the county islands. Again, and this is specific to county islands. So remember, when we talk about county islands, that means that some boundary of the city, jurisdiction of the city, is surrounding this area, that really the focus now will be on the purchase of utilities, the sale of utilities. And what we're asking is that we would continue to, we would now move towards selling utilities without the requirement of annexation. But the sale of utilities would require, though, the continued obligation to pay our utility services fee. And remember, this fee is really similar to what we require development inside the city that is hooking up to our utilities today. Today, if you build inside the city, you pay an impact fee, which essentially you're contributing to the large capacity, buying into the capacity requirements to provide services to those properties. We can't call it an impact fee because they're not inside the city. So this is a fee that is similar and will be directed for the same purposes to offset those costs for the expansion of our treatment plants and other larger facilities that are covered, that are not covered by the typical rate structure. The other requirements would be towards more the subdivision development requirements.
again, because this is an area that is typically adjacent to the city or nearby the city, whether we are the primary first responder or we are a mutual aid responder, we're concerned that these are really life safety issues, standards that we're requesting, whether it's the placement of fire hydrants, whether it's the development of the street, whether it's, I'm trying to think what other...
Those are typically the main ones,
that those become part of the requirement of receiving utilities. Again, this allows someone to come and receive those utilities without the requirement of annexation, but they do have to conform with these other standards over time. We think that provides for more planned and sustainable growth on our borders, and then it allows us to continue to provide those utilities. So that's what our proposal is, which is a little different than what we talked about last week.
Yeah. Vice Mayor?
I'm always fascinated by this discussion because every time I think that we've vetted it all out, or we look at it and say, here's where we're at, and then we come back and say, this is a new proposal. Say, well, wait, I thought that's what we were talking about before. Because really what it boils down to is the requirement for annexation that was in place before I started 6.5 years ago was pretty solid. But the reasoning behind it created a lot of problems. But what we really were trying to get at, and every time we've come back with an iteration of this, it is we want to make sure that we don't get substandard development that could eventually become part of the city, so that whenever we provide services, really our goal has been that they develop it to our standard so that we don't end up with substandard infrastructure down the road. And I thought that every iteration we've done over the last few years has been along that line, and yet this is new. Well, no, we're still just refining and trying to get it narrowed down, tweaking it so that we can get it where we really need it to be so that it works.
Right, and what we're really trying to do is streamline the process for those applicants who only want utility service but do not want to annex. Under the old policy that we're trying to tweak a little bit, they absolutely had to go through the annexation process. And then if it was determined that the development was not in the best interest of the city to annex, then they would have to go to the TIC to appeal that, and staff didn't have the ability to just provide utility services. So that's what we're trying to do here, is eliminate some of the cases that just want utility services, allow sale of utilities if they build to city standards, but not require the annexation process.
And to get past that misnomer that we can go on the cheap and still get the utilities. No, you're still going to have to buy into the system.
Correct.
You are going to have to pay the fees to buy into the system. You're going to have to build to the standards. And so if that is your sole reason for not annexing, then you're still going to pay. So you got to think about it long and hard. But really, we're just tweaking. So it's not any significant difference. It's just we're trying to make it easier to accomplish what we've been trying to do for a number of years now.
I think that's correct.
Okay.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I've come to realize this morning that discussions of water law and annexation are perpetual issues that will never go away. I first discussed this issue back in 1996 when I was chair of the Utility Committee, and we had all the similar issues. And I guess just from my perspective, I still favor the original policy that was adopted by the council. It's clear cut. You want utility services, you come into the city. And that I thought at that time was in the best interest of the community. It did encourage County Islands to become part of the city, because the continuation of County Islands will continue to pose problems for public safety purposes for both us, and for Rural Metro, the Sheriff's Office, and a whole variety of things. And so my position remains the same, so I will not support the new alternative. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. Councilmember Fenter.
Thanks. To clarify, when this came before the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, wasn't it option two that we had given our... Mm-hmm. So now staff has moved to an option three as far
after
as...
After our dialogue with the council as a group, we kind of got the concern. We kept hearing the concern about providing the services with annexation, so we wanted to come up with another alternative that allowed us to emphasize more the development standards and the development fee as opposed to the annexation. So it gives council another option.
Sure. Just as an observation, what I thought stood out as a positive under the original option two was
there could be an evaluation. The city could say that is not in the best interest because of fire coverage or anything. So it allowed the flexibility. And I appreciated that flexibility to kind of look at some of the individual needs. So if we're, you know, I'm just trying to get my head around now at three, and I'm still for the flexibility portion, whatever the best, if that's option two or option three. So thanks, ma'am.
Councilmember Higgins.
There's a couple questions I have. One that I don't think we've talked about is the change over the years from annexation of big areas to the single lot annexation. You know, we have a policy, but we're still agreeing that, you know, the 0.125 acre house is okay to annex in the middle of the huge community. So that's one thing we still haven't. I mean, we're still assuming we're going to be doing these spot annexations. So we actually never talked about that change.
Well, that's always council's final decision. If somebody wants to come in and they want to annex, we're not in any way limiting their ability to go through the annexation process. It ultimately comes to council, and then you're going to have a recommendation from staff as to approval or denial. I think what we've evolved to over the last year, year and a half, is we've looked at these individual parcels that are in the middle of an area that oftentimes it's not in the best interest of the city because of the cost of providing other public safety services.
When did that change? You know, in the old days, it used to be, you know, a neighborhood 50% plus one, you could annex all.
We will not do any adverse annexations at this point in time. Every property owner must want to come in. They actually have to, each property owner has to sign a petition saying they want to annex in.
And we haven't talked about the fact, do we want to have, you know, at least X amount of houses in a group or in at least a street or an area before we contemplate annexing anybody in?
We've actually tried to encourage that. Certainly we feel that it's better to have a larger group come in, and the way we actually set up the fee encourages multiple property owners to come in together because it actually ends up being more fiscally reasonable, or it's cheaper to bring a number of properties in as opposed to one at a time.
All right, and Mayor and Council, I do recall there were a few annexations that came in. They got fairly contentious because they couldn't get all the neighbors to agree, and so I think what the result of that was, the individual property owners just came to the conclusion that it was just easier for them to go on their own. Now, the difficulty is the cost, and that's what, frankly, without telling, you know, our larger groups that they need to get together and come in together, really these costs and weigh the requirements of them conforming to the standards will most likely, I think, draw larger groups together just so they can share those costs of running the lines for the fire hydrants or for the streets or paying for these utility fees. So, you know, it may happen only because of the economics of the cost of annexation.
Ms. Spinner.
Thank you, Mayor. If I might also add, Chris is right. We changed to a single lot annexation, and we had some very contentious annexations. But what really triggered the city's position that we will not annex without 100% of the property owners' approval or request is Proposition 207, which was approved by the voters, I think it was in 2007. Which, if we change zoning laws to a property owner, they can sue us for significant damages. So because of that proposition, it's now the city's position that we will not annex without 100% approval.
Councilmember Higgins.
I just want, the big thing that you didn't stress enough, of course, is that even though the property owner that just wants city services, because they're not annexing, but they do have to bring up their property to standards, which before, when we had talked about giving city services to people outside, we weren't saying you need, you know, to improve your road surface and all those things.
Actually, that requirement has been in place since 2001, that they had to build to city standards.
Build, but not, I'm saying if there's already a structure there.
Right, and that's typically been the problem. If someone pulls a permit in the county, and in some cases the county requirements are not as restrictive or not as aggressive as some of the city
standards. I think where the discussion is really what our problem that we're dealing with, because we're having a general solution that really applies to much different situations. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with Councilmember Kavanaugh that if it's new construction, they should annex in and build our standards. I think our real problems come in with the existing properties where you have the house that's sitting at the end of a dirt lane that now wants to annex into the city, and we're talking about improving up to city standards, and they can't use their septic anymore, or their wells run dry, or they need city services for some reason. Well, to me, those are two completely different situations, and I'm wondering whether administratively through your review process we can differentiate those two. Because I don't know that any of us have any interest in allowing somebody to go in, carve out streets, put in sewer lines, water lines in the county, and then come to us and ask for services. I mean, to me, if you're going to develop a property, whether it be 1 acre or 100 acres, and you want city services, you should come in and annex and come up to our standards. And I think that's what the councils in the past have said, that if we're going to develop, we're going to develop to city standards. And we've always said, because I've developed in the county, that if you're going to receive city services, sewer being the main thing, you will develop to city standards, which creates huge development issues trying to keep the county and the city both happy. But at the end of the day, you do develop to city standards. I think where our real, and those seem to be pretty straightforward and should be straightforward. I think where our real issue is are these orphan lots and these add-ons where the house has been there for 20, 30, 60 years, whatever it is, and it's a horse property that now wants, for whatever reason, to tie into our utilities. Yeah. And the cost of coming up to, let's say, fire standards is significant. It's horrendous. And the fact is that house will probably never be to our exact development standards because it's at the end of a dirt lane and it's a horse property. And it really is a county-type property.
Right. And, Mayor, I think what we would propose is to continue. Listen, we're comfortable going back to the option two that the council had and that we took to the committee. That's fine. We heard a lot of comments like we're hearing today. But one of the things that we would propose, we're still not eliminating the opportunity to appeal to the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, because you're right, there's those examples, but then there are examples of homes that are literally across the street from city boundaries, and you know, and it's like it puts us in question about if we're selling these utilities, certainly we should recover the cost of the capacity issues related to impact fees. The next question is, though, do we require the issue of the improvements of fire hydrants or streets? And in some cases, the extreme examples, you're right, it may just be impractical and feasible to do that. We would suggest, though, that those would be items that we would bring, as we have in the past, to the committee and allow for that decision to be made. You know, this isn't practical. Let's just sell them the utilities. They pay their fee, and we move on down the road.
Yeah, and it seems like you mentioned a third scenario, which is the existing house in an improved subdivision,
right,
that's adjacent to the city boundaries that now wants to come in and be annexed into the city. But their infrastructure that was put in when the subdivision was developed is not up to city standards. And now it's not only impractical, but one orphan lot in Dreamland Villa cannot make the kind of improvements that we would require.
Right.
So perhaps if we have this policy and then through the review and the administrative process, we recognize the differences in the situations, and I don't know how you apply that, but it seems to me like that's what we need to do.
Yeah,
we need to take a general philosophy, which is we are willing to, and I think what I'm hearing is we are willing to provide utility services without annexation. However, we will take into consideration all these other issues, such as if it's a new development. I don't think there's anyone here who would anyone on this council, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't heard that anyone would approve of providing utilities to a new development that did not build the city standards.
Okay.
Am I wrong on that?
No.
Okay. I think where our real problem comes in is in these two situations where we have orphan lots that don't have fire hydrants, they can't put it in because they're part of an already developed subdivision, or we have the traditional county property that needs utility services. We're the only viable provider, and yet they don't want to be annexed, and frankly, in many cases, we don't want them to be annexed. You know, we don't want to take on the responsibility of the horse property at the end of the dirt lane. But on the other hand, being the good neighbor and also for revenue and other things, we don't mind if they're willing to put in a sewer line that we will provide them sewer services. and then there is a base minimum of development that would be required simply to make sure that we can provide those utility services. So if whatever policy we have, to me, if through the administrative process we can give, first of all, the kind of upfront direction to someone coming in that says, here is the sense of what the council will and will not accept. And if I haven't summarized it effectively or accurately, please let me know. And through that process, we take into consideration the different scenarios. I think we'll be fine if we state that.
And I think in the ordinance
principle that we will provide utility services, but we also are very, very cognizant of the fact that we want people to develop to city standards, and where feasible and where possible, we want them to improve up to that. And we'll require that because we're not going to go out of pocket to provide services.
Correct.
Are you comfortable with staff making that evaluation, and if staff determines that it's not in the best interest of the city that we could provide utilities without annexation, or do you want those to come to council?
You know, the reality is that every situation is so unique that it doesn't matter. And this is, we're going back to, how long ago was that, Councilman Kavanaugh? Long time ago. You know, we will continually, we cannot come up with a policy that addresses every specific situation. And I think we need to state principles.
Right.
And we're going to have to rely on staff to apply those principles as best they can. I understand that in a perfect world, we would love to lay out in each sentence a requirement. I think what we need to do is do the best we can to state those principles. And good luck, legal department, in stating them. Well, I see you over there.
Mayor,
really,
what we'll do is, I think it's a lot easier to write the ordinance clearly as it's intended here, but with always the opportunity then to take it to the committee to work through those.
Yeah.
Odd anomalies.
Councilmember Higgins.
Okay, I hear two different things. You, Christine just said have staff have the ability to make the decisions. You're saying keep it the same with coming through the tick, and now
No. It always exists even today. Council's making, the staff is making a tremendous amount of decisions today about the qualifications for annexation and working out the details as far as what the requirements are. The way it's worked in the past is we can work that out with the property owner, and they're agreeable, then they move on down the road, but once we've negotiated that. There are times, though, when the property owner may feel that what's being required is more than they should have to do, and those requirements are unreasonable or impractical. They will then come and make their appeal to TIC. That's the way the ordinance is written today. What I'm suggesting is there are so many different variable circumstances out there. We will apply the principle that is being discussed here and work with the residents, the applicants, as best we can to make it work within this context. If we can't work out, and really the negotiation at this point is going to be how much of their obligations of the development regulations they'll be obligated to complete as part of the sale of the utilities, part of the purchase of the utilities. If they don't agree that they should be having to put in a fire hydrant or whatever, then, and we say no, we feel pretty firm that that's what needs to happen with this development, and they disagree, then they have the right to come to the committee and make that appeal.
Yep, but my understanding is staff does not have the ability to go into agreement for utility service without annexation. Isn't that a true statement?
The way the current policy was changed in April of 2006, it required every property had to go through the annexation process. Even if it was determined that annexation wasn't in the best interest of the city, that had to come to council.
Right.
What we're proposing is that if everybody agrees that it's not in the best interest of the city and the applicant doesn't want to annex, that as long as they build to city standards, we would have the ability to provide utilities.
I just heard you say we've already allowed staff to give city services
in part of the negotiation of the terms of annexation.
Well, I think we can probably give you more direction. I mean, for example, if it's a new development, when you say someone doesn't want to annex, and that's where I have an issue. If it's a new development, I think the consensus is that that's not an option.
Okay.
If it is a new development, and someone's starting from scratch, they should develop to our standards and they should annex in. Do I have a problem? Do we have a problem with that?
If they want the utilities.
If they want utilities. Is there any objection to that?
No.
Okay. I think what we're dealing with are the two issues, and when you talk about not wanting to annex, to me, that's your horse property. That's your house at the end of the dirt lane. And then I think we apply the standards of we will provide utility services, which is, this is the deviation. We will provide utility services, but we will not do it being out of pocket. In other words, we'll run a sewer line down a dirt road if we can without them annexing, because it doesn't meet our fire standards, it doesn't meet our road standards, but we can, they can put the sewer line in at their cost,
right,
to meet our sewer standards. Okay? I mean, you know, this is where we have the problem.
The way the current policy is, they'd also, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Because he said not meet our road standards, but you're saying even though they're not going to annex, they have to bring standards up.
Well, no, what I'm saying is our sewer standards. If our sewer standards include improving the road, then that would be part of our sewer standards. That's where I want to get away from, because what are our road standards for? Are those for fire or are those for sewer?
But I you know, because that is what we're saying. We're saying even though you're not going to annex, they have to bring the standards up. So well, that's what I'd love to.
And if that is part of what we're going to require to receive the utilities, because we say we don't want to have to drive, we don't want to have to service a sewer line and a water line going down our dirt road, that's fine.
All right.
If that's what we're saying.
Mayor, so.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just have a question. So alternative two says if the city staff concludes that it is not, the annexation is not in the best interest of the city, utility services can be provided without annexation. Alternative three expands it so that if the property owner does not want annexation, utility services can be provided. What I'm hearing from you now is you are more favorable to option two, which is...
I am favorable to option three, applying option two standards.
Right.
Okay. And Mayor, if someone comes in with the horse property and they don't want to annex, what we're saying now is that they would have to go through the annexation process. What we're saying is that, and maybe I'm misunderstanding this, and if I am, please correct me. I want right up front to be open and say it's the horse property. Listen, my water well, my wells run dry, my septic tank's gone. I want utilities. I don't want to annex. Right now, as I understand it, our policy is you still have to go through the annexation process. And that seems to me to be a waste. Right up front, we should say this is not an annexation. Staff has determined that that this is not something we would want to force on somebody because we don't want this annex, but we are willing to provide utilities under these circumstances. And that would be the circumstances would be to provide whatever improvements are required to safely and adequately provide those utility services. I don't know how we can enforce fire standards on somebody that we're not going to annex. Now, if they want to be annexed in the future, of course, now the fire standards come into play.
And
but if we're just putting in a sewer line and a water line, it seems to me like the requirement should be what would we require for a sewer line and a water line?
Okay, and so, Mayor, that is different than what the proposal is in front of you.
Okay,
so that let's keep that. That is an option.
I'm speaking for myself. Yeah, I've got six other people here.
I just want to make sure that we're clarifying that. That's a proposal the youth put on the table. Proposal?
I didn't mean to put a proposal on. I'm trying to get some clarification.
Well, right. I'm just saying though, what's being considered under option three really is taking that horse property would require that the city staff, or the direction we have, would be to say, okay, you want to buy our utilities, but as buying our utilities will require you, and this is where this is probably one that we wouldn't be able to work it out, you're going to be required to bring your property up to all the development standards, irregardless of whether it's related specifically to the sewer. It's related to all the development standards, whether it's payment of the fee, whether it's the road construction, and everything that goes with that. Now, what I'm proposing is, because we're going to run up against those horse properties, and even us sitting there and expecting them to run their, you know, 800 feet or whatever of road, we're saying that's obviously going to be fairly impractical, is what we're going to look to is to say, let's go to TIC and say, you know, this isn't reasonable. We've agreed to deviate from the stated principal policy of requiring you to bring everything up to development code, and let then the committee to say, you're right, this is, you know, let's make an exception here. Maybe their requirements, I don't know, there's some compromise in what the requirements might be. That's one option. Otherwise, we are not going to be in a position, if it's only this, both two and three, options two and three, the way they're stated here, as part of the condition of utility services purchase, you are required to bring your property up to development standards, whether it's the payment of the fee,
or whether it's the implementation of improvements related to that development.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins.
I would like to see option four more along the lines of what the mayor had put into place, where you know up front that the horse property at the back of the lane doesn't want to come in, and what is the reason for the road improvement? Is it for the utilities or is it for a fire? And if it's for fire, we're not servicing them for fire.
The challenge I see is the horse property, and we're dealing with the exception, but right. Exceptions seem to be the thing that take up most of our time. Is it unreasonable to have them put in 600 feet of roadway, but not 400, but 400 feet is reasonable? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know where you draw that line. That, to me, there's subjectivity in this that really doesn't make our city attorney feel very comfortable. And I can see that with how they're squirming down there. The fact is that I'm concerned that if you start trying to draw a line with each property, we're going to run into this issue where even if it is an appeal, I don't know what's reasonable. Is, like I said, is 600 feet of pavement reasonable?
And
or is 800 feet reasonable?
And the question we have is this, as going back to the issue of why the councils in the past, I suspect, have always made annexation a requirement of utility services, is because we are trying to address those issues in the county islands and improve it with the purchase of utilities. And the part of that is, the reality is, we believe at some point the city of Mesa will be responsible for those properties. And we would prefer to take the opportunity of the selling of our utilities to bring them up closer to our standards. And you have the horse property. That is going to be a difficult one. But you may have the subdivision that is a block away from the city services, city boundaries, and it may be more reasonable to say, you know, we are asking you to put in another fire hydrant. That may be the only requirement that is expected. And so we're trying to balance out us, kind of from the staff's perspective, looking out into the future and recognizing that these county islands, at some point, we expect, one, will either be our responsibility, or two, our responsibility to make sure that there's more of a sustainable development on our edges of the city overall. And that's why we've chosen to recommend, as we did in option two and in option three, at least the stated, you know, guiding principle is if you're going to either be annexed or buy utility services from the city, you will be responsible. The expectation is you're going to come in with the payment of the fees and developing to our standards. Now, we recognize, and it's been happening even with the current policy, we run into conflicts of feasibility and practicality to get that, and then we bring those exceptions. And they haven't been a lot, but they exist, and we bring those to the committee, and we talk about ways to try to achieve that with the committee.
Well, I maybe have to differ you a little bit that there hasn't been a lot. I mean, we have multiple cases that we've discussed in the short time we've been on here that seem to be similar yet extremely unique. And I think one of the challenges we've had is that what is the standard we're applying? And I don't disagree with how the policy was. This is in the past, because I think it was a righteous cause, for lack of a better term. It was really well-intentioned, and I don't disagree with the fact that what Councilmember Kavanaugh said, that if you're going to get utility services, you will annex. I think the realities are that there are some unintended consequences that we will have to deal with, and I don't believe that policy going forward deals with those realities. The unintended consequence is we'll have people that will never annex in, will operate illegal systems, will operate illegal wells and do things like that simply because they don't want to, and it's impractical for them and absolutely economically infeasible for them to come up to our standards because the property was built 50 years ago when there wasn't anyone within 2 miles of their house, and now they've been surrounded by the city. And all I'm saying is I think as a policy, we need to accept the fact that we will provide certain services to those people because we're their only option. I think we have a real moral obligation to make available certain services in certain situations. Yes, these are extremely rare, and I hope they are rare, but I think we at least need to have a policy that takes into account those without having to deal with 80 of them to come to the one or two. I think if we come up with a policy that deals with the 76 that we can just deal with at an administrative level, we'd be better off.
Okay.
And right now, we don't have that. Right now, we tend to have all these different kinds of...
Right now, we're not getting a tremendous amount of pills to the tick. What we slowed this down was related to the ability to deliver fire service, not necessarily related to the cost of delivering or implementing the development standards. That's not, I mean, we've had a few of those, but that's not what's held up this process. This process has been held up by the discussion about whether or not we can bring the fire services to those properties.
Well, but I think part of the process is the reason why that came to the forefront is by requiring annexation before we would require services, fire then came into play.
Right, exactly.
And we had several of those people who didn't want to be annexed, and because the cost of meeting our fire standards was prohibitive, and that's why it got to that stage. So I think that's a bigger problem than what we mentioned. Councilmember Fenter.
Thanks, Mayor. Where I found comfort in this, and I really toiled over a lot of this, exactly what we're talking about, is still going with the idea that we're trying to encourage the annexation, but we allow that flexibility. The check and balance is the TIC, or the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, which is a citizen peer review. I think we have the general idea of what we're trying to achieve. Having driven out there with different staff members, every situation is totally different if it's a wash or if it's a long or horse property. And so I think it's fair to say that a citizen review by fellow citizens, well-informed at a council level, could take those exceptions to the rules, and that generally we're encouraging them to annex. But there, just because of the fire situation, it just wasn't – there are areas that we can't cover, don't have the financing to do. So allowing that flexibility and really putting it at the TIC level to balance the citizens' concerns with staff. So that's where I was coming from.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, there's just one thing that came up the other day when we were discussing this, and that is the fact that in some of these county subdivisions where we're annexing just one lot, when, say, the neighbor, the guy who's in the city, passes out while cutting his grass, his neighbor calls and gives him an address. That when that neighbor calls from his house, he gets the county 911 system. He's not getting the city of Mesa system. So even though the guy who passed out assumes he's in the city of Mesa, you know, the neighbor calls for him from his house and the different fire services coming. Which, you know, I had more discussions yesterday. If that's different than what I understand,
It can be a problem just with depending on where the call is originated from. If it's in the county, then it goes through the county system. And that, and I know our alarm system is alert to that, and so that it can find its way to its proper location, but it does delay the process.
Well, and I don't mean delaying response, because someone's going to respond, mm-hmm. whether it's Rural Metro or the City Mesa. It's just that, you know, you assume that you're in the city, you're going to get the city service. And it's possible that in the instance that your neighbor sees smoke and he calls, well, he's in the county, he's getting Rural Metro's coming. So Rural Metro shows up, you know, so it's that kind of thing. And it goes vice versa. It could be the city of Mesa calls, the guy from the city, his neighbor's house is on fire, so the city shows up and,
that,
you know, then
correct.
Rural Metro takes over. You know, I mean, so it's just that information that just because you're now annexed doesn't necessarily mean, depending on the call, that you're going to get the city of Mesa responding. And that, to me, is more information so that you know only because you're in that unique situation where you're surrounded by county. So I just, that's one other thing that came up in discussion.
I don't know that you'll ever, as long as you have county and city next to each other, you'll never escape that. I mean, that
we and exist today.
On a daily basis, we cover each other, we count, we... We answer
with,
calls in the county. They
we
answer
do it with
calls.
All the other
we do it all day long.
Too, so.
Yeah. Have we confused you completely in this matter?
Pretty much.
Pretty much. Good.
Is there a consensus that you want option two brought back to give staff the flexibility when annexation isn't in the best interest of the city, that we could sell utilities, that we continue to be flexible relative to what we require, but if we have an applicant that is not willing for whatever reason to come up to what the city standards would be, that they have the option, obviously, to appeal to TIC.
Okay, and I think we got way too much in the details, and I apologize for that because I think I drove us there, so I'm sorry for that. I think the basic principle, just to summarize, is that this council, and the change in the philosophy is this council is willing, under certain circumstances, to provide utility services to non-annexed properties. I mean, is that, I understand Councilmember Kavanaugh doesn't agree with that, but other than that, and that's fine, okay? That's what I've heard. We'll let you guys come out with the framework that you apply that, because I don't know, we could spend all day, and we already have spent all day, talking about these details, so.
Mayor, if I might, I think what we can.
Councilmember Spinner.
No, I don't want to go there.
Watch out, Dennis.
I think what we can do is, if we have the ordinance as option number two, I think the staff can take the comments and the specific comments that you've talked about today and kind of incorporate them in the annexation policy. So when staff is evaluating, is it in the best interest of the city, they will be able to take into consideration the comments you've made.
I don't think the desires of the previous councils and their objectives in wanting to ensure the high quality development and those standards, I don't think any of us want to deviate from that.
Right.
And for any new development, certainly we would require that. It's just we're dealing with these unique situations that are going to keep coming up, and they're not going to be so unique. And we just want to give you the leeway to address those.
Okay.
And however you do that, I think would be fine with us. Vice Mayor.
Let's just throw a little more mud in the mix here. The development standards, we had some come to the tick where there was a requirement they had to put curb gutters on two sides of their house when it just feasibly was not reasonable. They couldn't do it.
Right.
How are we going to address that?
Well, we have a process in place, our favorite Just Ask Jack process, where we can take city standards and basically we can appeal to Jack, say, okay, we think that there's some modifications. A couple of those we said, well, rather than curb and gutter, you can do asphalt with a ribbon curb. We talked with transportation. They said, well, that side street really isn't going to go anyplace. We could eliminate that requirement. So that's the kind of dialogue that we've had. We get Jack, transportation engineering involved, and then if there's a significant deviation that we're recommending, basically we would come back to the TIC and say, we think that we ought not to require this for the following reasons, and then it's ultimately council's decision as to a different standard for that particular unique situation. Okay.
And then we are making sure we're getting dedicated right away for future and so forth.
That, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Is that okay? That direct instruction?
Thank you, sir.
Council. Sorry. I apologize. Thank you.
We all love this conversation.
Okay, item number four. Hear a presentation discuss the identification of potential costs related to providing other post-employment health care benefits.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. Just a real brief presentation this morning. With me is Donna Salemi, the Assistant HR Director, as well as Doug Yeske, the Controller for the City. Monday night, the council will hopefully accept the city's CAFR for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2008. And one item that's new in the CAFR that we just wanted to draw to everybody's attention is the reporting requirements that we've been working on for several years but are new to our CAFR this year. And those are requirements as required by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, or GASB. That it's requiring for this year, for the first time, of cities our size to recognize the cost of providing post-employment health care benefits. We typically call those retiree health benefits, or in our world, they call them OPEB, other post-employment benefits. So it's our OPEB requirements. In our CAFR, it's expressed as the annual required contribution by the city and any unfunded actuarial liabilities over a period not to exceed 30 years. Donna and her group have had our benefits consultants, the Siegel companies, prepare evaluation and determined that the total actuarial accrued liability for the city is approximately $664 million. That's again over the total 30 years, and with our net obligation for the fiscal year ending 2008 to be at about $57 million. Donna can speak to the OPEB, what the city's OPEB are, our Siegel process, and the changes that have been recommended by the city's Employee Benefits Advisory Committee. and then we can talk a little bit about what does this mean to our whole city financial process.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. Happy New Year, and let's make it all healthy one for all of us, being that we're talking about benefits. I thought it was an appropriate greeting. Brian has addressed the Governmental Accounting Standard Board new requirements of posting what the costs for the continued medical and dental insurance for our retirees. Even prior to the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, or GASB, coming up with the new standards, we realized as staff that it was an expensive program. Therefore, we started way back in 1992 in implementing requirements of service years in order to continue the benefits. Prior, if you worked just a few months and retired, you were able to continue the benefits. In 92, we implemented that you needed to have at least 10 years of continuous service with the city. Later on, in 01, we upped that to 15 years, and then in 2006, and for present hires at, prior to 1-1 of 09, it was 20 years of service. What do these benefits include? What are other post-employment benefits? Basically, it is the medical and dental benefits that we have as employees that we can continue on as a retiree as long as you meet the service requirements. There are premiums that the city continues to contribute, and that is what creates that other post-employment benefit liability. Whenever we have changes in any of our benefit structures, we have a committee called the Employee Benefits Advisory Committee, and Vice Mayor Kyle Jones is our chairperson, and Council Member Richens also sits on that committee. We bring this information to the committee so that they understand what changes we are making, what impacts they have. We asked, when we knew the GASB was coming to us and requiring us to post these benefits, we went through a request for proposal process, hired an actuarial firm, which also is part of, happened to be part of our present benefit consulting firm, the Siegel Company. They prepared an actuarial study. What does that mean? They took a look at the people who were present retirees, as well as those who will be moving into the retirement system for other post-employment benefits, made several assumptions based on age, life expectancy for themselves as well as the family members that will continue, looked at costs of coverage, how much if we put money away, how much interest rates or what they call a discount rate we would get, put it all into their formulas and came up with our beginning benefits, and that they had to project those costs out for 30 years. That was the requirement of GASB. So what the staff, looking at those numbers when they came in and knowing that this year we were going to have to post them, we were looking at other alternatives other than continuing the benefits. What we've decided to do at this point in time, and we went to the Employee Benefits Advisory Committee for approval on this, is at this point in time for new hires as of January 1, 2009, to suspend retiree benefits. And that, keep in mind that those employees who were hired on or after 1-1, if we kept things as is, would have had to meet a 20-year requirement in order to continue those benefits. We suspended them so that we could get a better idea of what this liability means financially to the city and what effect it will have on us. And Doug Yeske, our controller, will address that in a moment. So we have suspended those benefits at this time. New hires were advised. They are aware of the change in the benefits as they go through our orientation process as well as through the hire process.
Excuse me, Councilmember Kavanaugh has a question.
Thank you, Mayor and Donna. I just have a question in terms of a process. You indicated the Employee Benefits Advisory Committee agreed with this recommendation. I take it, because I haven't seen any minutes of your meetings or anything like that. I don't think we've reviewed or approved them. Shouldn't the council be the entity that approves a policy suspension such as this, or are we out of the loop?
Generally, with benefits, they're part of the annual process that we look at in terms of our budget process. So it's general when it information comes to council, it's usually through the budget process. We have not presented to council on regular changes to the benefits program. The one exception to that was several years ago when we changed the entire structure back in 2004, and I believe you were on the council at that time. That may be where you recall a full presentation. But generally, it's everything goes through the Employee Benefits Advisory Committee, and the members of the council who are on the committee will give us advice and direction on what to do. And then that goes, folds into our budget package for compensation and benefits.
Yeah, and I guess my question to Debbie, is that a delegation of council authority to two members of the council? In terms of, this is a major policy decision that's being made that doesn't engage the entire council or a majority of the council. And so just from a process standpoint, I'm curious as to how that can happen.
Councilmember Kavanaugh, I haven't looked at that specifically, but I'll kind of talk generally now, and if you'd like me to do some additional research, I'd be happy to do that. But I think what is being delegated is the allocation of benefits or the identification of specific benefits. And then that, as Donna said, that recommendation or that decision that is coming from the board is incorporated into the budget, which is presented to council and formally approved by the council. If the council wanted to specifically change those line items or those compensation and benefits, I think you could do that. But I haven't looked at the bylaws for the employee benefit advisory.
So as I'm understanding how you're explaining it, they can take action. If we want to override that action through the budget process,
yes,
we can do that.
Right.
And Mayor, as you're explaining it, as you understand it, generally, as with other boards and other departments, much like a department sets their compensation level or their other things, you're saying that that's how you understand that, that it could happen.
In those
now,
decisions,
if we wanted to, we could override that.
Similar
but
to.
But we don't have to affirm that as part of a normal process. That's
right.
What you're
saying. Yeah. Yes, Mayor and Councilman Kavanaugh, what we've really done is said to suspend. We have given ourselves and recognized that we need to come back to the committee and maybe if the council would like the full discussion about what other alternative programs we would offer instead of maybe even the existing program, or frankly, because again, these employees wouldn't be eligible for another 20 years, we could come back at any time and reinstate this. There is no current appropriation today for those individuals as it occurs. We actually make the appropriation as it relates to the expense of those employees that are retired. So one of the things we're doing this is to determine the readings that we're going to get. I mean, this is the first time. One reason we brought this up is because this is a significant disclosure item new in the CAFR. It's a large number. It's something new. The City of Mesa has been able to continue to pay for employee benefits for the last several, for at least over 100 years, and we continue to do that. This action doesn't necessarily change any appropriations on an annual basis, but it lets us review and determine what impact it will have on the actuarial. It also allows us to have further dialogues with our rating agencies, look at how other cities are responding to this. This is such a new disclosure. There hasn't been a lot of feedback. There's been a lot of feedback on the need to do it, but there hasn't been a lot of direction or guidance on what's a reasonable number for a city our size. So when we say we suspended it, we really just try to put it out, set it aside for now, either looking at other options of programs we could offer those employees, or maybe, frankly, determine that this number really isn't that difficult or whatever, isn't looked on poorly, and then we could reinstate that any time in the future. And I suspect that would be a discussion we could then have with the committee, and if the council would like, we could bring back to the full council.
Vice Mayor?
What this really did was that new hires coming in, they had to understand that we cannot guarantee that we're going to pay for your retirement benefits 20 years down the road. If things were to get better and it worked out, we could do that. Mm-hmm. But we're telling them up front right now, we can't guarantee it. we're protecting ourselves 20 years down the road.
Well, frankly, from an appropriation standpoint, right now, we're making those appropriations. It's really trying to understand this large number, this disclosed number, and what impact it has.
We're dealing with accounting disclosure requirements versus actual money out of the pocket.
Correct.
What we're doing is, to put it in context, if a 22-year-old were graduated from college and they had to figure what they were going to have to live on when they retired we're talking about 2042. That seems ridiculous. But, that's really 20 years. That's what what we should be talking about is should somebody retire at age?
Well, that's a police and fireman. If it's probably
42
30 years.
Mm-hmm. Whole other discussion. And the fact is, they're not going to actually start cutting checks to spend that. But it would be like reporting that as an actual current obligation right now and today.
That's exactly right.
Okay, Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. And I do understand. I was familiar with the change in the notification requirements, and I know that cities across the country are struggling with this issue. And it is, and the purpose is really to force cities to understand the nature and extent of what the future obligations will be. And I guess my concern, again, I'm going back to process, because this and create a distinction. This is not part of the discussions that we had last month with the budget revisions that we approved. This is a longer-term issue that we're looking at. And I guess, again, my concern is I don't recall getting notices of the Employee Benefits Advisory Board meetings since we took office. I have in the past when I was on council. I don't recall getting minutes of them as well. And I think if we're going to have a process by which, you know, two members of the council along with city staff are making substantive policy changes or recommendations, I think it's helpful to keep council members in the loop to these issues so we're not surprised at that, because I do understand every year that the good work that's done through the committee, that you constantly have to evaluate what is in the best interest of the community. That is rolled up in the budget recommendations each year, and manager and staff will come in and say, these are the assumptions that we're making, or these are the changes that we're making in benefits based on the discussions that we've had throughout the year. And so that's where I'm just saying, this is a little bit of a deviation from the process that we've been having, and that's why I'm hoping that we can work on that in the future. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Councilmember Fender?
The only observation I would have, and maybe this is further down in the presentation, is there part of this benefits an alternative product like a 401k or something, or will that be considered in the future as far as the suspension? So maybe you're going to get to that.
And I think City Manager Mr. Brady mentioned that's the purpose of why we're suspending this, for two reasons. Again, to reiterate, we want to see what the effect of this actual posting has on the city's financial picture. And we have looked at other products to offer and the costs of some of those products. And they can be rather costly. So if we just suspend them for a period of time, we would have a better idea of what would be the best direction to recommend to council.
And I guess as a follow-up, and I appreciate those comments, is if we're on a suspension of 2 or 3 years and we have a fairly recent new hire under this program, if it does, go to a mutual contributing fund or a 401k or something, there may be that time lost. So if the direction is we're kind of going this route and it looks like it, that I wouldn't want to delay it too long because we don't want to penalize the new hire.
No, we need to bring some. We'll follow up with coming up with some alternative programs. And again, you're right. We don't want to put anything where the new hires somehow is a disadvantage to them because of this. But we'll figure it out. Again, this is a long-term issue for them, and so we think we have time to sit down and have that discussion.
Okay.
And Mayor, I guess really just to finalize, unless you have other questions, we're going to take this time to not only determine that, but really to determine, as Chris said, what the impact of this is on our budget and bond ratings and things of that nature. We haven't gotten real good guidance yet from our bond rating agencies of yet what this again, we're going to show it as a liability, but what this liability does mean, what it means to us, what it means to the other cities in the valley and through the nation. So we'll learn that as we go through, as soon as probably this spring when we start talking to them and, right. and they see this for the first time
and,
in there.
And Mayor, you said it well. It's not, this is a new disclosure, but this dollar amount has existed in reality for years. It's just being disclosed. It not necessarily changes anything regarding our budget shortfalls as we know it today. We're not aware of any requirement that says you must fund that $650 million up to a certain percentage or whatever.
Well, so. Whenever we have accounting rules and disclosure changes, nobody knows how that will affect the overall markets because we're now dealing with a different scenario. The fact is, this is not something that just Mesa is dealing with. Every city and municipality, government agency in the country is dealing with this, and it will take time for the markets to adjust. It could be terrible. I mean, when they went to what's called the mark-to-market requirements for valuation of assets a few years ago, who knew that it would be a big player in the financial crisis we have right now? That was an accounting rule that changed the entire financial system. Who knows what effect this will have? I'm not saying it's going to be that negative, but the financial markets will somehow adjust. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our $600+ million liability probably pales in comparison to some other cities' $1 billion liability they're going to have to disclose. So I think we can just let it play out and see what happens and go from there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor.
Okay, item number 5, acknowledge receipt of minutes. Do I have a motion?
Second.
Motion by Councilmember Kavanaugh, second by Vice Mayor Jones. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? With Councilmember Summers, I had to leave to get to work, so I excuse him from that, so he was not voting. Here reports on meetings and or conferences attended. Vice Mayor Jones, one has a T-shirt on that I think you would like to report on.
Since we last met, we had a very significant event in the city, which it all starts here, which we are the beginning of the light rail running 22 miles through Phoenix, Tempe and Phoenix. Had a tremendous event, a huge turnout. It was very, very successful, and we our celebration and hope that it continues. We talked about maybe needing more parking, get that lined up just in case we do. So great events leading up to it.
Thank you. And I'd like to publicly recognize both our public information office, Steve Wright, and our transportation department, Mr. Mike James. And I don't know, Dan, if you had anything to do with that, Dan. Just a tiny bit. Okay. Because they played a big role in that event down at the Sycamore Station. They basically ran it with Metro's assistance, but our staff really ran it. And it was... Of all the events, it was universally recognized as the most successful opening event along the entire line. And second place wasn't even close. And that's actually not our unbiased opinion. That was the report we got back from Metro staff and from others who don't even live in Mesa, that our event was by far, believe it or not, the most exciting.
Yeah. We do know how to park.
Not boring. Boring. It wasn't boring. It was the most exciting.
And privately funded.
Yes.
Yeah, we do thank all our sponsors.
And
we had a tremendous amount of sponsors.
And our sponsors stepped up in these really difficult times to support that, because that was done with a lot of sweat and hard work, but a lot of financial support from our major sponsors. So truly a community event and truly a great part of building a better Mesa.
He got it that time.
Maybe we should change that to building a more exciting Mesa. We have enough excitement as it is. Building a boring Mesa. That's already built. I'm sorry. I was telling the radio yesterday that he said, well, what exciting things are happening in Mesa? I said, well, I could tell you, but I'd probably bore you to death. So... okay. Any other events or meetings? Okay. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. And also, we appreciate the city staff. Other departments were there. I thought that was very nice that our departments were there.
All city departments manned their booths, and there was a lot of And I have to recognize my chief of staff, Nikki Amberg, who sat in the stood in the shade and waited for someone to come help her. And we never showed up. She was the mayor and council, so thank you, Nikki. We were there. We just weren't at the booth, so she covered very well for us. So thank you, Nikki.
Mayor, just a reminder, we have our council meeting first of the year, Monday, January 12th. That's coming up this Monday. We'll then be followed by a study session on January 15th. And also a reminder that Monday, January 19th, is our Martin Luther King celebration. We'll be having a breakfast from 8 to 10 a.m. at the Mesa Marriott. And the keynote speaker will be Maria Reyes. So we invite all the members of the council and citizens if they'd like to join us in that celebration. Thank you.
And that event is run by the our MLK committee, which is a citizen committee, and they do a lot of good work in putting that on, and they are also supported by businesses and others in the community, so thank you to them in advance. Since I'm going to be out of town on that day, thank you in advance to them, because they do great work also. Okay, we have one pre-scheduled public opinion, Mr. Bruno DeGiorgi. I'm hoping I got that correct.
You got it. Yeah, you're one of the few who gets it right.
Oh, good. Mr. DeGiorgi, please, you have 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I think many of you already know me. I've emailed most of you. I'll give you, our case is very unique. A little bit of background. I'm a civil engineer. I'm also an overseer in the congregation that's building this Kingdom Hall. We contacted the city in 2005 when we bought the land. I was told no problem in hooking up to the sewer system at that time. It's unique in that the city of Mesa did all the improvements. You have your sewer tap on this property. 2006, we submitted our permit. 2008, we got our permit from the county. And I'll also share that we would have preferred to go with a septic system. It's cheaper. We don't have any cost every month. But because the city has the sewer tap on the property, it was the engineering and most logical way to go is contact the city and hook up. Also, ADEQ asks us to hook up to sewer when it's available, and I think your staff brought out, as long as it's under $10,000 hookup. Since then, with the permit, we're already started construction. On November 3rd, I came by to get hookup. I was told, no, you have to annex. I shared with them, no, you told us we didn't have to annex, and I was told, this has changed. You have to annex now. And it was like I was talking to robots. I asked, can I speak to somebody in supervision? They said no. And so then on November 4th, I submitted a detailed letter, gave it to them. They reviewed it, and they says, no, you still have to annex. So November 14th, I had my attorney contact Christine Zelanka. Didn't get a response right away. December 10th, I emailed just about every one of you. Let me see. The only one I heard back from was Council Member Higgins, and I appreciate that. At least I knew I was alive and the email got through. And then I called the mayor's office, and I will say this, Mayor Smith, Nikki Rosales is excellent. She got right on it. She called me right back. She let me know what the progress was, and at least I felt that somebody was alive there. Yesterday I got my answer from Christine Zelanka, and here's what she gave me. She says, I've determined that the city of Mesa can provide sewer service without requiring annexation based on your email request to Eric Nissen, or Nissen, dated Monday, September 4th, 2006. But then she put together the cost of hooking up, and it's $125,000. We could have built the septic tank for $10,000. I would have preferred to do that. The state allows you to put in a septic tank if your costs are more than $10,000, which was brought out. She did put down that if you would like to make an appeal to the Transportation Infrastructure Committee regarding the improvements, please let me know, and I certainly would like to do that. I'd appreciate if you would expedite that. The situation, though, is that we're in a bad situation in that we're permitted with the county, we're already under construction, we're going vertical. We did not plan for a septic. We have to now rechange our design if we're going to go septic. What doesn't make sense to me is that there's no cost to the city. Your sewer is already on our property. All we have to do is just put two pipes together. and I've had all this aggravation, and also now I'm getting a bill for $125,000. This is a nonprofit organization. We don't have the money. Also, I paid attention to your reviewing of annexation. I do feel strongly you need to allow your staff to make decisions, and you need to at least let people have a meeting so we know where we're at. Had I been told months ago, even years ago, that this would cost this much, we would have went in the other direction. I wouldn't have bothered any of you. But that's where we're at, and I want you to understand that. So I really would like that meeting, if it's possible. If not, we're just going to have to rechange our design, cut out part of our parking lot, and we'll put a septic system in. But none of this had to happen had there been some communication. And I repeatedly asked how much this would cost, and the city would not give me a price. I was told point blank, you have to annex first, then we'll give you a price.
Thank you. I think what you've had the great privilege of being caught in a transitional stage, and you should have gone out and bought a lottery ticket because you got so lucky. And I apologize for the I don't want to say the runaround because I don't believe you got the runaround, but I do think you got stuck in a situation where we, as you can tell by the discussion today, we have had some changes and are in the process of trying to figure out what exactly some of the specifics of our policies have been. And you just happened to step right into the middle of that. I'm hoping that with some of the direction we've made today, perhaps we can come up and give you some more direct guidance, and perhaps the staff will have the kind of decision-making, at least guidance and direction and authority that you've talked about. I encourage you to go ahead and apply for that. I think we've talked about how the Transportation Infrastructure Committee is the proper place to go. I think we can expedite that and do it as quickly as possible. And the council members who are members of those committee have now heard your appeal for quick action, and we'll do whatever we can. But once again, I apologize. You just arrived on the scene at probably both the best time and the worst time, and experienced most of both. So I would encourage you to move ahead with that. And we've all heard now what your specific problem is, and your issue is a poster child for the things we were discussing today and the conflicts we have with stated policy and policy that's in flux and is in transition. So I'd encourage you to move forward, and I think we can come up with a resolution that'll benefit both your congregation and the city.
Thank you.
Okay. Items from citizens present. Mrs. Crocker, do we have any requests to speak?
No additional requests, Mayor.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn. Moved by Councilmember Richens, second by Councilmember Kavanaugh. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We are adjourned. Thank you.